KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times journalist David K. Johnston joins us for the hour on this tax day to talk about government subsidies and private sector collusion that adversely affects the middle class and the poor as the rich get richer. His newest book is called Free Lunch, and he joins us in studio after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. David K. Johnston writes about tax policy for the New York Times, or he did up until Friday. He took a buyout and he's left the Times to become a full-time writer. He just informed me. And, well, he's been known for his work in the Times, the San Jose Mercury News, the LA Times, and particularly he's become known for uncovering so many tax dodges that he's been called the de facto chief tax enforcement officer of the United States. His last book, a New York Times bestseller, and investigative reporters and editors' book of the year, which he discussed with us on Forum, was called Perfectly Legal, the Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich. But how does he really feel? Well, he's won for that book both a George Polk Award and a Pulitzer, and he recently published Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. In it, he argues with, well, what some might say, duh, too, how the wealthy and the politically connected are favored by tax breaks, giveaways, and subsidies. But he lays all of it out with really excruciating, in some cases, detail and makes a strong case for how government has literally rewritten rules to help the richest among us to an even greater extent and in ways that financially affect the rest of us. David K. Johnston joins us for this forum hour. Good to see you again.
Well, thank you for having me, Michael.
And here you are making trouble again. On tax day, we have you here with us, which is really kind of apropos in so many ways. You know what I always hear about all this income going to the top one-tenth of 1% and so forth that you write about in this book? They pay the most taxes. This is what it's always the rejoinder. What do you say to that?
Well, high-income Americans pay a very large share of the taxes, the total pie, but of the share of their income that they pay in taxes, they pay about what you and I pay, what janitors pay. 3 years ago, I had a piece in the New York Times showing that once you make $10 million a year or more, your tax burden, that is the share of your income going to the government, starts to fall. And Warren Buffett has now confirmed that. He has shown that he pays 17% of his income, $46 million in the year he did this for, 2006, 17 cents out of each dollar in federal income taxes. But his secretary and his top executives all pay about double that. And that's one of the features that people don't grasp. But the reason that they don't is that there's, frankly, very little coverage about this in the news media, and there's an enormous amount of opinion coverage about how we are oppressing the rich in America.
Well, you begin with a posh golf course in your book, Bandon Dunes. Why begin there?
Well, Bandon Dunes gave a nice arc to the story. Free Lunch, like my other books, is done through the stories of individual Americans. It isn't policy. It's their stories, and you figure out the policy from reading about them. And Bandon Dunes was built by a libertarian, Mike Kaiser, and he wanted to play golf in the style that it was played in Scotland in the late 1700s when, lo and behold, who was writing The Wealth of Nations a few miles away but Adam Smith. And so it allowed me to connect this imagery with economic history. And I cite Adam Smith along with the Bible and Andrew Mellon all the way through the book as moral authorities.
Well, you sure do. You get to tell those notions like the invisible hand and the things that we associate with Adam Smith. But you also, throughout the book, make the point that government has shifted the rules, really, for the rich and against the poor, and it's rigged the markets in this era of deregulation. In fact, the truth of the matter is that it's not smaller government, it's larger government.
Yes. You know, when Ronald Reagan ran for office in 1980 and said, "Are you better off than you were 4 years ago?" He said he would bring us balanced budgets, less government, lower taxes, and market solutions to problems. Well, The government's just as big as it ever was as a share of the economy, if not bigger. The government is much more deeply in debt than it was back then. In fact, all the taxes withheld from your paycheck, those you pay in January, February, March, and April, one-third of the year, just go to cover interest now on the national debt. One-third of your income taxes, just to cover interest on the national debt because of borrow and spend policies.
The national debt, which keeps escalating.
That's right. Yeah. Keeps growing. We've had two balanced budgets since 1969. And that's all. These policies I show in Free Lunch have had the effect of redistributing income. Income doesn't occur in a vacuum. Government policies influence, and it has become the de facto policy of the government of the United States to funnel income to those at the very top.
Including George W. Bush, as you point out in your book.
Yes. One of the great ironies of George Bush is he'll go down in history as this great tax-cutting president, although, as I point out in the book, you didn't get a tax cut. All you got was a deferral of your taxes because all the money was borrowed, and now you're paying interest on it. But President Bush made his fortune by getting a tax increase funneled into his pocket in Texas.
You go into some detail on that. You also go into detail about a lot of other people who are right at the top, in addition to the president, or at least at the top of the food chain when it comes to having money, and talking about people, you mentioned Warren Buffett, but also people like George Steinbrenner. You even bring in Paris Hilton's grandfather. I mean, these are individual cases that kind of make your case, Donald Trump particularly. You've been kind of a bête noire of his, haven't you?
I broke the story back in 1990 when I was at the Philadelphia Inquirer that Donald Trump's own net worth statement showed he had a negative net worth of $600 million, or as we put it on the front page back then, you are probably worth more than Donald Trump.
And yeah, he was real happy with his ego about that,
yes,
as I recall. Yeah.
Yes, and Mr. Trump, I show in the new book, his casino company got $89 million from a tax the state of New Jersey imposes to help the poor.
Now, these are exactly the kinds of things that really, in fact, I'm going to go to your book for a minute here, because you say early on in the book, there is, of course, no such thing as a free lunch. Every cost must somehow be accounted for and paid. When bars offered a free lunch in the 1800s, the cost was built into the nickel charge for beer. For our purposes, a free lunch refers to an economic benefit received by one party that is paid for by another by government action or inaction. For example, when a developer receives a plot of land free or at a discount, your taxes may have paid to buy it. The original owner may have been cheated out of its market value, or someone else, not at all obvious, got stuck with the real cost. When an executive shortchanges the pension plan, making his company appear to be more profitable, he inflates the value of the company's stock and therefore his stock options. When the pension later fails and the workers get less than what they were due, or the taxpayers have to make up the part of the shortfall guaranteed by the government's pension benefit guarantee corporation, the executive gets a free lunch. Our economy is riddled with these subsidies, many of which are intentionally subtle and hard to detect. And that's kind of the heart of really this book.
Yes, that we have adopted an enormous number of policies, Michael, that are either little known or hidden, that remove risks from wealthy people, that put money in their pockets, that provide them with buildings and land and all sorts of things free. We give Tyco $500 million a year of free labor. And there's just an enormous number of these policies. They get very little coverage in the news media, and when they do, they are often described in bureaucratic language favored by the proponents that doesn't explain what's really happening.
Well, one of the most dramatic examples is when, say, a Walmart or big box comes into town and they want to get into town, and there's another town that wants them, and so they get subsidies, essentially.
They go to the city fathers and they say, we'll build this Home Depot, Walmart, Targets, Cabela's, whatever the store is, if you'll go out and use your power of eminent domain to take the land we covet so we don't have to buy it in the marketplace and pay the real price for it. And then they want something called tax increment financing, which is a good example of the bureaucratic, meaningless language. I don't think very many people have an idea what tax increment financing means. What it means is the sales tax that you pay at the cash register doesn't go to the government. Instead, it is kept by the owners of the store to pay the costs of building the store. Now, that means, on the one hand, that your police department, your fire department, your schools are not getting that revenue. But it also means the local merchants who are fully taxed and who turn over the sales taxes they collect are competing against this subsidized national chain. And it's a major reason that, for instance, when you drive down the El Camino Real, when I was a boy growing up in Santa Cruz back in the 60s, you come up the El Camino Real, it was all locally owned businesses. You drive now, it could be, except perhaps for the trees that are around, in Texas or Alabama or anywhere else, it's all national chains.
Drives the small retailers out at the same time that it takes from the coffers of the local citizens in terms of tax money.
That's right.
We're talking to David K. Johnson. His book is Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense, parenthetically he adds, and stick you with the bill. Economic pollution is another concept that comes across in your book, and it's an important thing for people to understand.
Well, you know, when a company dumps toxic waste down the drain into the river or spews them out of a pipe into the air, we recognize that as the company not covering its real costs of production and degrading the quality of life and perhaps endangering health and safety for everybody else. Well, when a company doesn't cover the real costs of its business and shifts them off to you and I as taxpayers, it does something even worse. It pollutes the economy, and it uses the coercive power of the state to collect taxes not for public benefit, but for the private benefit of that company. And I show a number of examples about this, including cases where people died and there were economic incentives to let them die.
You also reference some work by Elizabeth Warren of Harvard Law School in your book. And, I mean, certainly a lot of people go into bankruptcy because of divorce, major job loss, or medical problems. But the extraordinary thing that I've never seen this statistic, one out of seven families wind up in bankruptcy court?
Since 1980.
Yeah,
since 1980,
right.
Yes. We've had an enormous surge in bankruptcies in this country, and we have, at the behest of the credit card companies, changed the rules in ways that favor their interests, which is a part of this whole story, how government, because our elected political leaders rely on campaign contributors, a narrow group by and large, and not only for campaign contributions, but free jet flights and meals and all sorts of other stuff. It's their interest that they think about, and they write the laws to benefit their interests. And so we've created this system where we've had this enormous surge in bankruptcies, and it has devastated lots of families. And because of government policy is a major contributor to this. I mean, it doesn't mean that people don't have responsibility for handling credit responsibly, but the fact is government policy is a major factor in this.
Well, one reads your book and finds out about these government policies, and then you think about all these bankruptcies and what's going on in the banks or the airline industry or, for that matter, with the subprime crisis and with Bear Stearns, and you think, boy, Bin Laden and his company couldn't have done worse damage to our economy if they had planned it, you know? We're doing it to ourselves.
We are very much so doing it to ourselves, and we're losing things. We used to think of Detroit as Motor City. Well, guess what? Ontario is becoming the automobile and truck manufacturing center of the world, and government policy is driving that in two related areas. One is the costs of health care do not appear on the books of companies in Canada. The society has the cost, but it appears on society's books, on the government's books. So the business doesn't have to divert energy and effort from making whatever product or providing whatever service it does to deal with health care. And secondly, because their system is more efficient and provides high-quality health care at a much lower cost, they're able to spend more money on other things, particularly education. So in the American South, when you have these free factories being built and given to Mercedes-Benz, BMW, and others, they train the workers using color-coded cards because the education system is so bad. In Canada, they give you a manual with real words in it, and you have to learn those words, even if you're a blue-collar worker, to work in the factory.
Well, we look north to Canada, we see some extraordinary dramatic differences economically in so many other ways. And what I glean from your book, when you write about this billionaire class getting richer and richer at our expense and the expense of the middle class, that is, and poor people, you compare it most to, well, Brazil, Mexico, right to our south, and Russia.
Right. There are very good worldwide statistics on income. We don't have real good statistics on wealth, but on income. And when you look at them, you see among the modern economies of the world that Europe, Canada, Japan, New Zealand, Australia are all sort of bunched together in terms of inequality measures, something called a Gini coefficient. But when you look at the outliers, the ones out on the edge, there's four countries out there, Brazil, Mexico, Russia, and the United States of America. That's not exactly the sort of territory I think most Americans want to associate themselves with or think with. I mean, do you really want to live in a country with these dire extremes that you see in those other three countries? And yet that is the direction that government policy is pushing us towards.
All countries of rich oligarchs, basically.
Yes, yeah. That's right. Well, basically, more and more oligarchs at the top. Poor people who are losing ground, and it's clear in the statistics in the United States that the poor are actually losing ground, and we have more poor in this country than we did, say, 20 and 30 years ago, and a middle class that's struggling. From tax data, the average income of the vast majority, the bottom 90% of Americans, is the same in 2005, that's the most recent year we have data for, as it was in 1980, and it's smaller by $74 a week on average than it was in 1973.
Talking with David K. Johnston, his book is Free Lunch. And by the way, if you think this is politically colored, you're on record as saying openly that you're a registered Republican, so we want to make that...
Sure. And the book is about both the Democrats and Republicans. The problem is with the system and not with either party. It's with what's happened to our political system.
Well, you know, the best way to measure that, in my judgment, is when you point out to the statistic that since 2000, we have two times as many lobbyists. What has happened on K Street is 35,000 lobbyists. And a lot of this, you know, you go into, for example, secret payouts to corporate CEOs. A lot of this is because of the lobbyists.
Yes. There's nothing wrong with lobbying per se. I mean, government, after all, should be taking petitions from people and listening to them. But we've created a system in Washington because of the campaign finance system in which members of Congress and the Senate, and I interviewed more than 100 senators and congressmen for this book and my previous one about this, they spend all their time listening to the pleadings of the very rich and large corporations. They spend relatively little time hearing from other people. They're scheduled
by
the
political system that gives them access. That is,
that's right. And so it's like being in love. You know, when you're in love, you think about the other person and yourself all the time, the two of you. And that's what's going on with our politicians. I had one New York State senator tell me that when we took a cab ride together one day.
So what do you mean by being in bed with a politician?
He and I shared a cab one day from the airport. And I was telling him about the last book I was working on. And he said, you know, in the 10 years I was in office, I would get up every morning when I was shaving. I would think about my 10 biggest donors and what I had to do for them to keep their donations coming. Even if I knew I could never get what they wanted, I had to show them I was trying to get it for them. And he said, you know, I don't think I ever once stood there and thought about the average constituent in my district.
I've had politicians who have told me they spend literally all their time talking to those who are going to provide them money as opposed to, you know, serving the public. But that's another story. But, you know, you would think that maybe with all the scandals with Enron and with Bernie Ebers and all the talk about transparency and accountability and so forth, that legislatures, both national and statewide, would have moved in quantum and dramatic ways. Just hasn't happened.
No, because the real constituency of most members of Congress is their donors. I mean, look what happened when the issue was raised about the taxes paid by hedge fund managers. The top 25 hedge fund managers in America are among the group that said, if you raise our taxes, the whole economy is going to go to hell in a handbasket. And these guys make $11 million on average. $11 million a week on average. And they pay taxes at the same rate as janitors, 15%. School teachers, radio hosts pay at a higher marginal rate than that. And who was it who rode to their defense and saw to it that there would be no change in the law? It was two Democrats, Charles Rangel, who represents Harlem, and Chuck Schumer, the senator, senior senator of New York.
Speaking about New York, we learned from your book the Yankees and the Mets will collect $1.3 billion in public funds.
Oh, it's gone up. It's now north of $1.5 billion, and I'm sure we haven't heard it all yet. This commercial sports thing is an astonishing area.
It's where W made his money.
That's where Bush made his money. The tax increase funneled into his pocket was to finance a baseball stadium. And when they sold the baseball team that he put together a partnership to buy, its value went up by $164 million, but the subsidy was over $200 million, which means that the market did not add one penny to the value of the team. Only the taxpayers did. And the manager of the team, George Bush, was not even competent enough to capture the entire subsidy. He only captured $164 million out of the $200 million-plus. In the Washington Nationals baseball team, the owners paid $450 million for it, but they're getting subsidies of well north of $1 billion. So basically, the taxpayers bought the team for them and are now paying them about $550 million to take the team. This is absurd.
How about taxpayers paying for something like Bear Stearns?
Well, this is a real troubling area. I think people should be very concerned about what's going on here, both in the immediate case and structurally. Bear Stearns is an investment bank, and they are notorious cowboys on Wall Street. It would be polite to say that they push and bend the rules. And they made awful bad bets. Well, in a capitalist economy, when you do that, you're supposed to go broke. The government stepped in and rescued these guys. They had a lot less money than they used to have, but they still have a lot of money. And basically, you could argue that this is a policy that no billionaire will be left behind. But there's a second, more important principle, a moral hazard principle that I talk about throughout Free Lunch. If when somebody makes awful bets in the market, gets rescued, then other people will do the same thing. And in this case, it may, the government argues, was necessary to bail them out because of all the interlinking of financial instruments through derivatives. But then we should be asking the question, why have we created a system that is so unstable that the failure of one firm, Bear Stearns, would threaten the whole economy?
Talking with David K. Johnson on Tax Day. His book is Free Lunch. He's also the author of the New York Times bestseller Perfectly Legal, which, as I said, we talked about the last time he visited us. You get kind of rough in some ways in your language here. You call some of these people bandits with pens as opposed to pistols. You say some of these company executives are, well, in fact, corporate criminals.
Yes. What I mean? Well, look, we have a system in which in the market economy, you could make a lot of money, okay? And I'm not averse to corporations. I'm actually the chairman of the board of a little company that my son and I have. I don't have any aversion to making money, but make your money in the marketplace. Go earn it. And don't get the government to pass a rule that reaches into your pocket and takes money out of it and gives it to you. Go earn it in the marketplace. It is easier to mine gold from the treasury than from the side of a mountain. Well, it's also a lot easier than earning it in the marketplace. It's hard to make money in the marketplace where you have real competition. But if you can get government to restrain competition, handcuff Adam Smith's invisible hand, set up rules that put risks on your customers and rewards in your pocket, that's not market economy. That's not competition. That's corporate socialism. And we have become drenched in this corporate socialism over the last 28 years.
A lot of people getting the message from you, getting riled up. I can hear my listeners' blood pressure rising. What do you tell them to do?
Well, first thing I hope they do is that they read Free Lunch so they understand what's happening. I mean, I write these books to explain to you things that you probably do not know about. Very few audiences that I've spoken to have known about many of the devices that I describe. But then we can do something about it. In fact, I think, Michael, the only thing you can say that's un-American is we can't do anything about this. I mean, we got rid of slavery. Women talked men into giving him the right to vote. It took a long, long time, but they did it. And we can solve this problem, too. We didn't used to have this problem. We didn't lavish money on rich people in America in the 1950s and the 60s. We did in the late 1800s. We're doing it now. We can stop it. But people have to first learn. And if then all that happens is they're talking about it at the coffee shop and the Starbucks and the hair salon and at church on the steps and riding on the bus or sitting in the plane with the person next to you, if people start talking about this, it will begin to affect our political culture.
David K. Johnson, our guest, and we're going to open our phone lines and certainly invite you to weigh in here with any opinions you might have or any questions or comments you have for our guest. Again, his book is called Free Lunch, and you're welcome to join us. The toll-free number for your calls, and this will work whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786. Again, you're invited to join the program toll-free, 866-733-6786, or you can send an email with your questions or comments. The email address is simply forum@kqed.org. Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Our guest, David K. Johnston. When we return, your calls and emails on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with David K. Johnston this hour, and he's the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who worked for many years up until recently with the New York Times and has written a new book called Free Lunch. And we're going to go right to your phone calls. And let's begin, David, with you. Good morning.
Yeah, hi, Michael. And David, is it?
Yes.
Yeah. Greetings. Hey, I wanted to ask, there's probably a pretty obvious equation for this, but when does America go broke? If it's given that we've refused to tax the wealthy and the national debt is rising at an exponential rate, and then, of course, with exchange rates, it's always a disparate rate. I'm just wondering when that happens. And if I could ask a second question, there's the subprime, there was a Supreme Court ruling recently regarding the subprime, happened a year or so ago, and it allowed major corporations to do when your local government is able to take over property for the benefit of the community.
Eminent domain.
Eminent domain, right. So with eminent domain, it was allowed that eminent domain could happen in the name of putting in box stores and raising the local economy. Well, if the local economy is now nationwide going to go into the tank because of these same major corporations, and then they're going to come in with asset forfeiture, how many of the states around the nation have been able to put together new laws to protect themselves against this?
Well, okay, let me deal with the first question about when are we going to go broke as a country. I think we're a long way from there, but lots of things will happen first. One of them is people will stop lending money to us. The Chinese government will decide it doesn't want to hold American bonds and notes. And that will affect interest rates, and it will affect all sorts of government policies. If we continue down the road of borrow and spend, we will reach a point where we'll end up defaulting. But I suspect that that's quite a ways away from where we are today. Instead, what you're seeing is the crowding out of money spent on other things like education, health, infrastructure, highways, roads, things like that.
Are we in recession?
Well, there's a technical definition of a recession. I think we're clearly in a contraction. I don't think there's any question. The economy has not been doing well since 2000. The average income of Americans is lower than it was in 2000, and this has been throughout this decade that this has been going on. I've shown from tax data that this was true. The low point was in 2002. 2003 was essentially flat. There was a little bit of growth for those who make over $100,000 a year in income from 2003 to 2005. Half of it, however, went to those people who make over $1 million a year. That's one in 500 taxpayers. They got half the increase. The system is skewed more and more towards income growth at the top.
And we go to Oakland next. Amelia, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Just a quick question for your guest. Response to Alan Greenspan's very interesting assertion in his recent memoir. Greenspan thinks that the reason the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer is our K-12 education system is what he calls dysfunctional, so that we are producing a plethora of persons with skills that are only suitable to low-wage jobs as opposed to the kinds of knowledge workers that are being cultivated in, for example, India right now. And I'll take my response off the air. Thanks for a great show.
All right. Thank you for the call. David?
Well, there's no question that our education system's country is in awful trouble. On my next book, that's one of the things that I'm working on, and I've been finding all sorts of inner-city kids went to high school and were never given a book to read. They were shown movies. But the increase in income that's going on at the top has occurred over such a short period of time that it cannot be explained by the education system. That doesn't mean there isn't a long-term problem. The increases in income at the top are occurring largely through finance and things related to finance. And we have a whole set of rules on world trade, global trade, which in the long run is a good thing to have. But in the short run, the rules have been written to benefit the financier class in the securitization of all sorts of things in some fundamental changes in the economy. And part of it driven by technology. New technologies always produce large new fortunes.
Eric, thank you for waiting. You're on Forum. Good morning.
Hi. I guess I'm just disappointed in the lack of suggestions about what we can do about this, because I think many of the problems you're raising are old news to anybody who's actually paying attention. So the number of power grabs and money grabs, both look at Proposition 13 as a cross-generational money grab, the home mortgage interest deduction is another way that the poor subsidize the rich, all of the more extreme and egregious things you're talking about. But so there's people for whom this is old news, and then there are people who don't care or aren't going to do anything about it. I think there needs to be some sort of creative process by which we get to a solution. And I guess I'd like to hear more talk about what can actually be done about this when you have entrenched interests. You know, even the fact that we have a job category called tax accountant, and there are, you know, people making however much money manipulating this system, those people have an entrenched interest in keeping the system the way it is.
Well, let me dovetail your remarks, Eric, and I thank you for them, with an email from Brian in Santa Rosa who says, what are the top three things the average citizen can do?
Okay, well, first of all, I'm an investigative reporter, so my job is diagnosing problems and
not necessarily prescribing.
Not necessarily prescribing solutions. And Eric, I assure you, if you got my email and my letters, it's not unusual for me to come to work and get a voicemail that would begin with things like, you blankety blank communist pig, I hope you and your family all die. There's places on the internet where people have promised that as soon as the revolution comes, I am the first person that's going to swing from a tree. There are a large number of people who do not see the world the way you do, even though the government data is overwhelmingly clear about what's happening. Now, as to solutions, well, the first solution, and I'm sorry if you think this is vague, but the first solution is people have to decide they're going to be citizens. When I was a boy in California, I remember sitting as a little kid in Orange County listening to the Orchardists, and they would have four or five newspapers there at the barber shop and Saturday morning, and they would talk about how the government policy was doing this or that. They paid attention to it. They elected to office people who were going to watchdog their money and see to it that they got minimal and efficient and effective government. Secondly, we absolutely need to stop trying to use campaign finance reform. We have gotten in campaign finance reform from the Supreme Court the functional equivalent of the Dred Scott decision on race. So we need a different solution. I propose in Free Lunch that we go to a 100% payment of the expenses of Congress. I call it politician finance reform. Politician finance reform with zero tolerance. We'll pay all your expenses. We will have a disclosure of every penny that you spent. If you take a cup of coffee from a lobbyist, you go to prison. Some people think that that's naive. Okay, let's get a discussion going about what to do. But simply changing the national discussion will change things, because politicians listen and are aware to some degree of what's happening. And if we get away from this worshiping people on the content of their wallet and go back to focusing on the content of their character, we'll begin to get some change.
Well, here's an excerpt from, I just want to get your response to it, and we'll go to some more emails and calls in just a moment, but from the review of your book by Jonathan Chait, a review that you took serious exception to and made that exception clear, in a letter to your then-former employer, The Times. But he says at one point, I just want to get your reaction to this, Johnson portrays deregulation as evil, almost as a matter of principle, since you were talking about people who say you're a communist and all that. Even a sales trucking deregulation initiated under Jimmy Carter, which liberals up to and including such New Deal social democrats as Robert Kuttner have judged a success. He regards corporations not as necessary entities that sometimes work at cross purposes to the public interest, but as inherently malevolent ones. The true visionaries, he suggests, believe that, quote, business is at all times engaged in a conspiracy against the public that ought not to be aided by government policies.
Well,
I can see why you get some of those phone calls, I guess.
Yeah. The problem is that Mr. Chait just makes things up. I mean, I'm in favor of less regulation. I propose in the book ways to have less regulation. I show how the creation of LLPs, limited liability partnerships, has been an awful effect, because we had a self-reinforcing system for accountants and lawyers to behave, and we replaced it with a system that eliminated this minimal self-regulatory system that rewarded virtuous behavior and punished bad behavior. First of all, there is no such thing as deregulation. If you believe there's deregulation, I want you to meet my friend the Easter Bunny. There's only new regulation, and I show in, as you referred to it earlier, excruciating detail, how many of these new regulations—
I meant that as a commendation.
Well, thank you, and I'll take it that way. But I show how in many of these areas, the quote-unquote deregulation put in place new rules that artificially inflate prices, thwart competition, allow companies to get together and legally rig markets to go towards monopoly prices. Now, there have been some big successes. I mean, look at the airline industry as a result of lower pricing and removing rules. Trucking, particularly less-than-truckload trucking, has changed significantly. It is a mixed picture, but the general trend I show has been towards new rules that favor a narrow group of people. Corporations are wonderfully efficient vehicles for conducting business and accumulating and building wealth. But you also have to have rules. Everything has to be subject to some kind of rules, and rules define a civilization. And the rules we have are defining a civilization of the rich for their interests, not for the common interest and the commonwealth.
So here's a listener who says, can you please comment as to whether you see any hope for equitable changes with any of these three presidential candidates?
I don't think in the short run you're going to see change. The situation we're in arose over a long period of time. It's involved on the economic front every president since 1980. And I believe that's in large part because the campaign finance system that we set up in the 60s and the 70s now allows this narrow group, the political donor class, to weed out for very high-level office anybody who is not acceptable to them. And so it's going to take time. I mean, we need to look at how do we break this grip. Public finance campaigns may be one way to do it. And curiously, you know, you would think with publicly financed campaigns that incumbents would gain an advantage. Well, it turns out that where they have them, that isn't what's happened. Another thing we can clearly do is pass laws requiring that congressional districts be as close to evenly divided between D's and R's as possible, instead of what we have now, where we have solidly D and solidly R districts, which tends to produce people at the extremes instead of the center.
Talking again with David K. Johnson, his new book is Free Lunch. Let me, before I go to more calls, just go to a few more emails. Dave says, shades of Steve Forbes, you feel a flat tax with no deductions, other special treatment would be more fair than what we have now? It seems the complexity of the code helps allow this sort of abuse.
Well, the complexity of the code is principally the result of special pleadings and favors. The problem with the flat tax is the guy who dreamed it up, Robert Hall, intended it to have multiple tax rates. And in this book and in the paperback version of Perfectly Legal, I explain the moral principle about progressive taxation. Progressive taxation is the idea that gave birth to democracy 2,500 years ago. Every classic worldly philosopher, Adam Smith, even John Locke, George W. Bush, are in favor of the principles of progressive taxation.
You're putting him in the same category with Locke and Adam Smith?
And Adam, at least in the sense of their belief in progressive taxation. And the Steve Forbes flat tax is, as I have shown in the New York Times and had said to Steve Forbes' face on national television, is basically a device to allow Steve Forbes to live tax-free.
Here's Dave, who says, does your guest have anything to say about the co-establishment of the Federal Reserve and the federal income tax? It has been argued that this pair of policies is nothing more than an age-old scam by international bankers to guarantee payments to the federal government from the people so that the interest on Fed-created money can be guaranteed to the bankers. And I've heard that in all my years in radio.
And I just think it's nonsense.
And here's Chris, who says, why do even supposed critics of the administration, such as Paul Krugman, go along with the bailout of Bear Stearns, saying that the financial system would lose credibility and people would lose faith, causing runs on banks?
Well, that's why I made the caveat a little earlier that we have this interrelationship system because of derivatives and credit swaps that has so interconnected people in the banking system and resulted in people not really knowing what is the value of this or that structured financial vehicle, this derivative, that instrument, that there's this enormous fear that if even someone the size of Bear Stearns, which, well, a huge corporation is to the economy, minuscule, could bring down the whole system. 10 years ago, during the Clinton administration, long-term capital management, started by two Nobel Prize winners as a hedge fund, was rescued by the government because it turns out they had borrowed, in some cases, $250 for each dollar of equity and overall about $100 for each dollar of equity, and were so intertwined in so many deals that if they collapsed, it could cause a domino effect. So it may well have been necessary to rescue Bear Stearns. Then let's fix the system so we don't rescue more investment bankers and save them from their decisions. Let's have market capitalism, not corporate socialism.
Keep coming back to it. Let's fix the system. I mean, we were talking about the Pope's visit and the Roman Catholic Church. It was the same thing last hour. Let's fix the system. But things tend to drag along, like you said. I mean, there's a kind of lag that almost mitigates against fixing the system.
Well,
there's making it impossible.
Michael, there's a large, deep problem that's arisen in our society, which is that we've become so prosperous overall that many, many people do not see the connection between government policy and their own lives. They've outsourced the operation of government and said, well, let other people do it. I'd rather watch American Idol. And the result of that has been policies that are narrowly defined to favor a relatively narrow segment of our society. And that's what I document in Free Lunch. And people have to decide. You want to live in a democratic society? Guess what? You got to spend some time being a citizen.
Some more of our citizens will get on with us here. Jonathan, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if, David, you could comment on countries in Europe, particularly, you know, England and the European Union, and how they're able to do so well. I mean, the pound is to the roof, and the euro is doing extremely well. What are those countries doing right? I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. We thank you for the call.
Well, you're into a good part of my next book, which I've just started work on, part of the reason I took a buyout from the New York Times. But fundamentally, here's what I would argue. In 1980, Mr. Reagan set us on a whole new course and really dramatically changed America. We were told that what we were going to get were conservative policies. If conservative in the classical sense means we keep those things that we know work and we're very skeptical of newfangled ideas, what we got was not conservatism. It was radical ideas led by people who think that, for example, no public park should exist. No child should be allowed to go on a swing without paying for it. And I tell how Milton Friedman promoted these ideas because that's improper, coercive use of the state's power. And the Europeans, the Canadians, the Australians, the New Zealanders, they stuck with things they had found worked. And lo and behold, you go to Europe now and you go talk to journalists, my class of people. In Europe, they're not mired in debt. They own houses free and clear, or they rent. They don't worry about changing jobs because of health care. They don't face the risk of bankruptcy. They've made fundamentally smarter choices about efficiency and effectiveness in the modern economy. We have pursued a group of radical ideas that I think after 28 years we can reasonably judge have they been successful. They've had some benefits. There have been absolutely some benefits from the system, but there's been a lot of damage. Let's keep the benefits and let's work on getting rid of the damage.
Well, you seem to argue that most of the benefits go to the very rich, though.
That's true, but clearly there have been benefits. I mean, for example, trucking quote-unquote deregulation, elimination of the government choosing where an airline can fly, or to what city. Not entirely limited because there's something called slots, but the federal government limiting that. Those have been success stories. There have been other success stories in our economy, and you want to keep the things that work, but those policies, and they are growing in our society, that take from the many to give to the few are the ones that we should be questioning, particularly since we live in a society where all of our elected politicians, virtually all of them, tell you that they are believers. Well, the religious texts they say they believe in denounce as evil, and that is the word, not my word, the Bible's word in the Old Testament, the New, evil, taking from those with less to give to those with more. Those are policies that are indefensible based on their claimed beliefs and that Adam Smith denounces and that I think clearly we need to address instead of enhancing and growing, which is what we've been doing.
Well, we're going to a call up in Sauk Rapids, Minnesota, and that's you, Tom. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I'm in Georgia right now working, but I gave you my hometown. But I'd just like to say, as a left-winger who's occasionally dabbled in Marxism, it's nice to hear a Republican speaking the truth about the disasters that have been inflicted on this country since Reagan. And I particularly appreciated your comments about Adam Smith just now, because, again, most of the people who talk about Adam Smith, he wasn't railing against government regulation or government over control. He was railing against a government system that basically rewarded a few privileged rich elites at the expense of the rest of the economy. He was against the royal subsidies and the royal monopolies that were granted in his period. And We're basically doing the same, as you said, we're doing the same thing all over again with corporations. And that's my comment, and I'll take in a response off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the comment.
Well, Tom's exactly right about that, Michael. Adam Smith was very concerned about subsidies. And what I show in the book and cite Smith throughout is you have businesses getting together and getting the government to put its thumb on the scale on their behalf, and it causes awful damage to the economy. It concentrates money in the hands of a few, but overall it is bad for the economy. And in many ways, free lunch is a defense of markets. And trust me, a lot of business people out there, they don't like markets. They're hard to make money in.
Here's a listener in Oakland, Concepcion, says the only Democratic presidential candidate who really called attention to income inequality was John Edwards, and he lost. What does that say about how Americans in 2008 feel about this issue? I agree that growing income inequality in our country is one of the biggest problems that should change how we approach public policy very broadly. Example, maybe we need more government social fixes like universal government-paid health care. If we live in a world where health care is only affordable to a high-end professional or government civil servant, then everyone else is left without. Just a comment. And here's a listener in Marin who says, would the U.S. have been able to continue the borrowing to prop up our economy had we, like most other countries, held our debt in a foreign currency? Or would we have a major currency crisis on our hands akin to what happened in Argentina? And what is the rationale for assessing different tax rates to stock dividends and interest income from a bank? It appears it favors the wealthy.
Well, on the last point, the first one I'm not an expert on, but on the last point, Andrew Mellon actually wrote about this in 1924. Andrew Mellon, oil man, banker, Treasury Secretary of the United States.
And revered, great philanthropist.
Great philanthropist and revered by many of the proponents of Reaganite policies. He wrote in his book, the question has been raised whether one should tax more heavily the income from a man's labor or the return from capital. And it is beyond dispute, he said, that we should tax capital more heavily, for a man's ability to earn a living and set aside money for his old age is limited and can be taken away by accident or illness or conditions beyond his control, whereas capital produces an income without effort and may be disposed of as you choose and passed on to your heirs. This is Andrew Mellon, understanding the fundamental principle here that one wants to create a society where you tax capital more heavily, and yet the trend in this country has been towards eliminating taxes on capital.
Gordon, you're our next caller. Welcome. Thanks for waiting.
Hello?
Yeah, hi. Gordon, you're
on
the air.
Yeah, hi. Two very fast questions. Is for Medicare, is 2018, is this a really hard, bad date, and 2045 for Social Security? I'll take your answer offline.
All right. Thank you for the call. Those are the dates, of course, that are thrown out as being sort of doomsday dates. Yeah.
Well, you know, Ronald Reagan had a commission headed by a then obscure economist named Alan Greenspan to address Social Security. You now pay about one third more in Social Security taxes than the government pays out each year in benefits. That money was supposed to be used to pay off the national debt and build up a storehouse of wealth that would be drawn down in the future. Instead, Congress and the president went and spent the money. And I would argue they spent it on tax cuts for those at the top. We are going to have serious problems because of our debt in the future, but don't buy the horror stories. Social Security is a very relatively easily solvable problem. The big cost area is going to be Medicare, advances in technology, longer lives, and this curious system we have where we have socialized medicine for the president and Congress, for government employees at all levels, and for anyone who makes it to the age of 65, but not for everybody else, including children. And the decision to treat healthcare in America as a business rather than a service. You know, nobody talks about kindergarten insurance or a prosecution insurance. The decision to create the system that we have is one of our core financial problems. And there are three chapters in my book about that, including how we created billionaires with your tax dollars.
You also mentioned Social Security as being, well, easily remedied. What about the proposal that we had that really never took loft of President Bush, that it should be tied to the market and investment should go into Wall Street?
Well, think about that for a minute. Who's going to vote those shares? If the government's going to vote them, then you're giving government power over the market. If you're going to say the government won't vote the shares or vote them in proportion to something else, then you're saying that the managers of the companies will be even less accountable than they are now to the shareholders, which has been a historic problem with the running of large companies. I think the American public made it pretty clear that they were not interested in risk, that they did not want to be put at the risks of the market. They wanted instead to have a system where whatever else happens in your life, life may go grand and things are great, or some disaster strikes you, or you don't run your life well. When you get to be old in this country, you're not going to starve.
John, let's get you on here. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Yeah, hi.
Thank you, Michael. And David, I had the question whether the information about the differences in income distribution between the countries where it's fairly narrow and the ones like Brazil and the U.S. and so forth, where there's a huge discrepancy between rich and poor, has that gone into in more detail? And could you talk about that? Has it gone into more detail in your book? And could you talk a little bit more about the consequences of that?
Well, there's more. Yeah, I mean, there's more about everything we've talked about in the book. That's why you do a book with 100,000 words in it. But fundamentally, what happens if you shrink your middle class, then and concentrate money at the top, a whole host of problems begin to arise in your society. The most important one of which, in the long run, is social stability. You begin to erode social stability.
And I thank you for the call, and we've sort of come to the end of this hour, but boy, what an enlightening hour it's been. David K. Johnson, thank you for your work, and I want to remind listeners, the book is called Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Good to have you here again.
Thank you, Michael.
Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David K. Johnston. Well, we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour's repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. We'll be back with you on tomorrow. We'll be talking to, really, in my judgment, a great writer tomorrow, Jhumpa Lahiri, a fiction writer who has put out a new collection of short stories. And we're going to be talking about Hillary Clinton in the opening hour tomorrow, continuing the series we've been doing on presidential candidates. We've done Barack Obama, we've done John McCain, and tomorrow we'll do Hillary Clinton, so it'll be complete before the Pennsylvania primary. I want to remind you that our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our producers are Tina Larberg and Kevin Guillory, and we've had production assistance throughout the last week or two from Nick Vadinsky. I want to also extend thanks to engineer Danny Bringer and remind you that you can let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum simply by emailing us forum@kqed.org or calling our listener call-in response line at 415-553-3300. And for all of us at KQED Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.